Welcome to Road to Black Tech Week, where culture, capital, and creativity collide. In this episode, we bring you a powerful conversation between Damian Hooper-Campbell, Chief Impact Officer at StockX, and the moderator, Thornell Jones, Managing Partner at the Ovation Agency. From redefining corporate culture to prioritizing mental wellness and evolving DEI frameworks, Damian brings transparency, vulnerability, and wisdom to the stage. If you're leading, learning, or just trying to show up more authentically in your work, this conversation's for you. And don't forget, Black Tech Week 2025 returns to Cincinnati July 14th through the 16th. Register now at blacktechweek.com. Let's dive in.
For your startup to grow, your product and company must be innovative and imaginative, always looking for ways to develop and advance. Maintaining a culture of inclusivity and understanding is always important to draw people with these ideas into your company, but also to keep your people there. Damian Hooper-Campbell is StockX's first ever Chief Impact Officer, where he oversees not just DEI initiatives, but also external community engagement and giving in sustainability globally. In this fireside chat, Hooper-Campbell will explain his journey and experience as a Black C-suite leader in tech and what innovation and culture means within a company and how it benefits growth to develop a company culture. Welcome, Damian Hooper-Campbell.
Thank you. Blessed to be here.
So let's get right into it. In your current role as StockX's Chief Impact Officer, you seem to have found a perfect intersection between who you are, what you love and do well, and something people value. So luck, intentionality, or both?
First of all, what's up, brother? Good to see you in the flesh.
Good to see you as well.
We met like 10 minutes ago in person for the first time. You know, the beauty of virtual communication is that you get to know somebody before you ever actually meet them, but it feels good to actually see you in the flesh. And also, big shout out to Black Tech Week. Big shout out to Cincinnati. Thank you for having us here. So, you know, I think it's probably a combination of all those things, luck, intentionality, et cetera. It really, for me, is God. I'll tell you, in my career journey, there have been some like detours where I'm like, wait, why am I doing this?
Right.
Right? There have been some things that have just fallen out of the sky. And then there have been some things that I've been very intentional about. And every single time I question, you know, the path.
Right.
5 years later, I look back and I say, oh, that's why you had me do that thing.
The proverbial light bulb.
Right. It's coming back. And right. So with StockX, you're right. It is that perfect intersection. I've been a sneaker enthusiast. I'm not a sneakerhead. Sneakerheads know like the date something's dropping. They know the colorways. They know all that stuff. I don't care about that stuff with all due respect. I care about how it looks, right?
So exactly.
I grew up as an artist all the way through college. And for me, you know, growing up, I couldn't afford sneakers. My mom, single parent, couldn't afford them. And so StockX for me has been a dream because I've been collecting sneakers. I wear my sneakers, number one. I get to go to work like this, number two. In fact, for my interview, the CEO was like, yeah, don't even think about wearing a blazer over here, brother. Like, your biggest consideration needs to be which kicks you're putting on your feet. So that's a blessing. But more than that, if you think about heavy consumers, you think about how sneaker culture was built. That was built off the Black community.
It sure was.
It's maintained by the Black community. Look at what's popping. That comes from hip hop and music and fashion. That's us. And so the opportunity to work for a company that is founded in and headquartered in the blackest city in the United States of America, and to be in a role reporting to the CEO where I get this opportunity to go to work like this, to be in Detroit on a regular basis, but also to advocate on the customer side, on the employee side, and on the community side, it's all coming together. And so I would say it's a mixture of luck, intentionality, and primarily just God's path for me.
Understood. I can relate to all of that because you know, even though I really loved my role as a systems engineer, I knew that I wanted to be closer to music, which was my heart. And that took me into a whole nother path. And I know my family, my dad in particular, did not understand it. I don't know if your mother was. My dad was like, and then one day I was, you know, sitting in the, you know, the crazy thing about it is, like he said, we met virtually, and then we had the opportunity to kind of like do some digging behind the scenes, and I discovered that he is me. We both studied economics. I had a dream of being an investment banker. That did not happen. So I ended up going to marketing because I found that I had more aptitude for that, right? And, you know, once again, you know, you reach these points of intersectionality and you're like, well, I can either, you know, make a left-hand turn and do this, or I can make a right-hand turn and do this. And, you know, I made a right-hand turn and it turned out for me. But, you know, I also know that within that process and over the last 30 years, there's been a lot of left and right-hand turns. This panel's about innovation and culture. So we're going to get into that. What does innovation culture mean to you in your professional setting? Do you still uphold your definition while still following the mission and vision of the company you work for? Or is this really more about putting your imprint on things?
I'll answer the back end first. It's both, right? It's about upholding the vision for whatever organization I've become a family member with, but you get hired. Each one of us gets hired because we bring a unique view. None of us are hired to be robots.
Right.
You got people creating robots now to do jobs. We're hired because we have individual paths and some unique view that companies want. And if you're a founder, you believe in that uniqueness you bring to the table, and you've decided that the world needs a little bit of that. So, but at the same time, if I am part of a family,
right,
and that family has a definition of values and a mission, then I'm also going to play within that and sometimes push that definition to evolve,
right?
And so, but to the first part of the question, what does innovation and culture mean? This may sound a little cheesy, but it's air, it's life. It really is, especially inside of a company. You have so many examples, right, of companies who failed to innovate. And we don't talk about them anymore. I won't name them up here because it's no shade, but we don't talk about them anymore, right? Culture, especially for a company like the one that I'm in, especially for some of the businesses that you all are leading or the things that I think matter, mm-hmm. purpose,
right,
community,
right,
that is culture.
Right.
And so to me, innovation is what are you doing to stay not just on top of what's moving, but to also define it, right? We talk about the wave and people being the wave. Yeah, you can ride the wave. That's part of innovation. But how can you actually be the wave, right? So I think about innovation that way. And culture, I remember I worked, you know, on Wall Street, very different attire than this. The investment bank I was working for, one of the people said, culture is what happens when nobody's paying attention. Because companies can put these things on their websites, they can get a bunch of people together and come up with all these nice, dope, fancy words. But what actually happens when leaders of the company aren't around? What actually happens when something goes wrong and you can see people's true colors? That's culture.
That's a very interesting way of looking at it. I agree 100%. Yeah, it's when the chips are down, when there's a crisis, you know, what are people really made out of? You know, when people take off their masks, what are they really made of?
That's right.
Yeah, absolutely. That's wild. I told you are me. Okay. Leading the C-suite in this moment of the world's social and economic clients, don't you love how they framed that? It's calling on leaders to grow and broaden their skill sets. How has this shown up for you?
Okay, so let's talk about this for a second. First and foremost, I want to send love from me to every single person in here. We're in a wild time in the world. And I ask myself sometimes, like, Is it just that the world is like more bugged out today than it was years ago? Or is it that technology just puts these things in our faces all the time? But I'm telling you, every time I think I can come up for air in my personal or in my professional life, something wild happens that makes me say, how can another human do something like that to somebody? Or, wow, look at Mother Earth, Mother Nature reacting to some of the poor decisions maybe we've made before, and it's costing us. So I know every single person in here feels blessed to be here right now, and I hope you have a blast. I also know that there's another part of each one of us that is going through something having to do with the world that we're in right now. And for me, the skill set, so, okay, put it like this. People in my role 10, 20 years ago, or in some variation of the role, we were tasked with, okay, how many people of color, how many women are we going to hire, right? We were tasked with unconscious bias sessions that were 90 minutes long, and, you know, it's supposed to heal everybody from unconscious bias, right? That was then. Now that's table stakes. In this environment, when, you know, the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade, people in my role are being asked to hold conversations inside of the workplace that address that. When you have issues that come up about affirmative action or about whether or not somebody can actually provide services to a person based on their sexual orientation, we're expected in the workplace to talk about that. We're also expected to talk about controversial things that may happen in pop culture and whether and how that affects us, how it affects our customer. Right. And so I would describe this role. My role is chief impact officer. That's maybe a more corporate name for it. But I see myself and my peers who do this work as healers. I see us as therapists. I see us as coaches, as mentors, as family members, as experts, as facilitators. It is literally, when you think about roles inside of a corporation, it's one of the toughest, which is bugged out, y'all, because people think that this is fluffy work. They think it's fluffy work. But the honest truth is, some of us don't even want to talk about politics at our dinner tables. We don't want to talk about women's rights at our dinner tables. We don't want to talk about the LGBTQ plus community with our grandmamas who may have grown up a certain way at our dinner tables. And now we're being asked to talk about it in work. And so what I would say to you, kind of combining those two questions, the previous one, innovation, well, the market is dictating. Candidates these days, you all out there are saying, I want to work for a company who's going to not run from these issues, but who's actually going to create space for them. So we have to innovate. It's also culture, right? How in the heck are people going to come to work and be productive if they're walking in worried about the latest killing of a black person, and that's weighing heavy because they've been watching it on the news all day, and nobody on that Zoom call or nobody in the office even acknowledges it? It's survival. That's what I mean by innovation and culture is survival. And so that's my role. And so I've really had to expand, you know, my thinking. I was at another company where we had to create space to talk about Palestine and Israel. What? Nobody wants to do that in most cases. I love doing it because I think
most people get uncomfortable.
Everybody's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Everybody's uncomfortable. But I think if we can get past the discomfort and actually hear each other, we can actually understand each other, maybe not necessarily agree with each other, but we can understand each other. And if we can understand each other, a lot of the violence and the things that are happening out here, a lot of the ways that we look at each other, we can get past that. And so we have to run towards those conversations in order to do the work.
You absolutely have to lean into it. Do you have like a statement, a culture statement that everybody in the company adheres to?
You know, that's funny. Not a culture statement, right? We have core values that are around being committed to what's right and playing on a dream team. But if I'm keeping it a buck with y'all, we're always reevaluating that. We're reevaluating it for language. We're also reevaluating it to say, does that still resonate? If that's what the company was founded on, you know, a few years ago, well, guess what? Our workforce has changed. We've grown, we've gotten smaller, we've grown again, we've become a global company, right? Serving people across the world. Like, is this still relevant? And so I don't know that there's necessarily a written thing that we adhere to. I do think in our interview process, we make it very clear though, of what we're about. And I think as people come into the company, I heard somebody the other day come in and he joined at a senior leader level, as a VP, and he said, I just wanna say that what you all said, the good, the bad, and the ugly, what you told me in my interview process, it's all been true. And ultimately, that's what we want. We don't want to be sold a bill of bad goods, right? When we're interviewing. If a company says, this is what I stand for, great that it's on your website. We want to get in there and actually see that they're walking that talk.
That is, that's what we call authentic. That's what we call authentic. You know, obviously, you're trying to attract the best and brightest talent that you can. At the same time, you know, from when I got in the workforce to now, that this notion of authenticity in being able to bring your full self to the workplace is something new. This, I mean, today the concept of the mask still continues, and yet I remember, you know, like I said, I worked for IBM, the biggest, one of the biggest companies in the world. We had 350,000 employees, and the one thing that made me know that I could navigate that space was this phrase that everybody leaned into, and that was respect for the individual. And, you know, and it was a global company, so, you know, there were, you know, engineers from India and Africa and Southeast Asia, and obviously here in the United States. And, you know, it was an interesting time to be there. And I didn't realize that most companies didn't have that as one of their core values. Yeah, so this is the reason why this is, you know, kind of leads me to the next question, which is really just an extension of what you've been talking about before, is you've had the opportunity to work at a number of different companies. And as a Black man who's in this DEI role, how does, you know, your personal experience inform your job?
Ooh, that's a good one. I mean, I would say, brother, that I wouldn't be at any of these companies if not for my personal experience as a Black man. Mm-hmm. Back to bringing your unique perspective on life. And let's be honest, the Black culture is not a monolithic culture. There are many varied and diverse experiences within our culture. So what does it mean to be Black is very different. But as a Black man who was born to a father from Guyana, a mother from New Jersey who grew up in a single parent household, born in New York, New Jersey, south side of Chicago, Connecticut, who lived in places where I was the majority, but then also in places like Fairfield County, where I went to high school, I was one of eight Black people out of 800, and then went to Morehouse College and understood even more about the diversity in the community. All along kind of, you know, that path, I've been asking myself questions about why we do what we do, but also questioning what does it actually mean to be Black, and also questioning not just other cultures, but also questioning our own culture and saying it's fine for us to look at other cultures, but are we looking at our own culture as well?
Right.
And understanding some of the stuff that might be with us. Mm-hmm. And so what I've taken away from that, you know, living in Spain and studying abroad and all the things, right? My wife is from Haiti, so our two-year-old daughter is Guyanese, African-American, and Haitian. All I've taken away from that is more commonality than difference. And we talk a lot about privilege. Sometimes we ascribe that to white people in particular, and there's definitely white privilege. I have enormous privilege as a Black man inside of corporate America in a role of influence where people are asking me for my opinion.
Yeah.
Enormous privilege. And we don't talk about our privilege enough. We talk oftentimes from a place of deficit. I have enormous privilege as one of only, you know, a handful of allies
right.
on the board of the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation,
right.
GLAAD.
Right.
Because then I take everything I learned there about the non-binary community, about the transgender community, and the intersections of blackness. And when I'm in family conversations where people tell me how they really feel about things,
I
exercise that privilege as somebody to educate them.
Right.
And so what I would just say is, okay, all right, thank you. But I would say my experience as a black man, let's be clear, that experience has many layers of diversity in it. And I take that into these companies, and I just want to give a shout out to the companies that I've worked for because they've all shaped me, right?
Right.
I've been at a nonprofit in Harlem, UMass. I've been at Morgan Stanley, at Goldman Sachs, at Uber, at eBay, at Zoom, at Google, and at Harvard Business School, and now at StockX. And in each one of these places, I've realized one thing. We are all human beings. And we have more in common in our struggles than we oftentimes have space to even realize. And so as a black man,
right.
when I'm engaging with people who are not black and they kind of very quietly come up and say, well, I really want to get involved in this employee resource group, but I don't think I can because I'm not black. Do people want me in there? I now have privilege
right.
to say, we need you in the group.
Exactly.
Don't get it twisted. We're not going to stop talking about black stuff. We're not going to hide because you're in the group, but we need you in the group because if we are just together in a silo,
right.
where in most corporations, we're the minority anyway, and we talk about our challenges and come up with ideas, but we don't have anybody else from other communities in that conversation, we ain't going nowhere with it. It's limited.
True.
And so that is the privilege that I get a chance to exercise in bringing my very diverse definition of what it means to be a black man into the corporation. The last thing I'll say really quickly is I also bring a lot of pain into
sure.
it. And that is a challenge, quite honestly. Like when I see things happening, I'm gonna try not to get emotional, but when I see things happening, yesterday I saw something on IG, y'all probably saw this, where they did an experiment with two people who were blind.
Yeah.
Did y'all see that?
Yeah.
And one was a white man, one was a black man.
Right.
And they showed reactions of people when each one of them in separate experiments would walk up and like touch somebody as if to say, help me.
Right.
And it broke my heart to see how people reacted to the black man.
Yeah.
And so I bring that pain in, one, to connect, but also to educate. But it's hard. It's hard to separate that out from time to time to make space for everybody.
That's really heavy because I saw that. It obviously, and people start sharing it. So it came to me several times. And somebody said, the one that really pained them was the guy who actually wiped his arm off.
Mm.
Yeah, that was really painful.
Yeah.
I actually love how this is unfolding because we are kind of getting into a personal space. When I was growing up, one of my cousins had Down syndrome. And, you know, my aunt was very intentional about keeping her engaged in the family. So while she's no longer with us in this realm, Dorothy really set an example for us for compassion. And, you know, through the history of our collective relationship with the medical community, we tend to, particularly as black men, not talk about our health and or see the doctor and or, you know, or speak about health and mental health issues. While I don't have anyone close to me who has been diagnosed with like autism, for example, you know, I do have family members whose children are on the spectrum.
Yeah.
So I've been really proud of some of the people who I've either worked with or who are extensions of my family who have really done a deep dive in that space because a lot of us have gone undiagnosed as being, you know, on the spectrum. You've been open about your diagnosis with ADHD, and June was Men's Mental Health Month, and July is National Minority Mental Health Awareness Month. Can you talk about your prioritization of mental health in your personal and professional lives?
Yeah, sure. And again, love to y'all. Please do not suffer silently. Again, every experience I've had has taught me that when we actually get okay to tell somebody, yo fam, I'm not okay, you'd be surprised how many other people maybe are not okay or were not okay and can help you to get to a more okay place. So please do not suffer silently. Look, I didn't even really have a choice to prioritize this. As a kid, I was bad. I can only imagine. I was bad. I got expelled from like two schools between kindergarten and first grade. I'll tell y'all later about what I did. I know y'all like, what could you possibly do to get expelled from? And single, you know, black mom who was working on Wall Street, traveling 2 hours each way every single day. And, you know, they wanted to put me in special education classes.
Of course they did.
I was very smart, but behaviorally, I just couldn't stop getting in trouble. And they said, oh, maybe it's because his father's not around. And I remember at one point in elementary school, they used to have somebody come pick me up. And I would go to another building and do that, like, with a psychiatrist. Do that thing where you got a piece of paper, they open it up, put a little ink dot in the middle, and then close it and open it up again. And it creates these very beautiful, artistic,
the like, Rorschach
images.
Test.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's beautiful. And say, what do you see? And, you know, back in the 80s, I'm 44, so I was born in 78. So this is now early 80s. In Jersey, my mother, strong black woman, was not having any diagnosis of her child. And we had a stigma for what ADD was back then. Fast forward, I remember sitting on my stoop in Brooklyn right before I went to Harvard Business School, and my cousin Eli pulled up. He had just like switched from, converted from being Muslim to Christian, and he pulled up on his bike and he was telling me just about life. And he said, and I've begun seeing a psychiatrist who specializes in black men. I go to see this individual. We spent a couple of sessions. He asked me if I've ever been tested.
Right.
I said, no. Tested, he said, man, you're off the charts. That was 2006. Every single day, unless I forget,
yeah.
Since then, I take a little white pill for my ADHD. And the reason I talk about it, and every time I talk about it, I especially talk about it in corporate places where we go in and wear masks.
Pow.
Every single day, we wear masks. And when I talk about it there, I talk as loudly about it as is possible. People always come up to me and they say, thank you, I have this, and I didn't think it was okay for me to talk about that. And so, yes, I see a therapist. My wife and I see a black therapist who focuses on black couples from the diaspora. And we have challenges just like any marriage, but we don't have like big, big, huge ones. But why wait? Preemptive medicine and healthcare is what we're about. And so the other reason is kind of back to what we talked about. People in this role, so black folks in general, we carry a lot, and we carry it into the corporate space. Now you add on things like us taking care of our families. My grandmother's 93, praise God, she's alive. My mother's in her 70s, and my stepfather just passed, you know, a couple of years ago. So I'm having to step up and play a bigger role. My wife does the same thing. We carry a lot. Now you go into a corporate space, and you're being asked to talk about these tough things in the corporate space. So I have to go see a therapist because people are pouring into me their stuff.
Exactly.
I'm pouring into them, and sometimes I'm just empty. And so I prioritize that. My wife and I just went to go see a nutritionist together. We took a week off just to focus on stuff at the house, on finances, on taxes, on stuff we needed to get done around the house, on the piles of clothes that have become furniture in our room over the past 6 months, right? And one of the other things we did was we said health is wealth. And so we drove an hour and a half to Jersey to go see a therapist and have been changing the way we eat, changing exercise regimen. So it's a long answer to the question. If you look at the most successful CEOs, for the most part, they're in good health. And the worst thing for me is to be one of the only black men on some of the boards that I'm on, to be the only black man on the leadership team where I am now reporting into the CEO and to show up unhealthy.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And health to me, again, is it's that trifecta of, you know, my physical, my mental, and then also the spiritual. The spiritual, I'm still on a journey.
Sure.
I've grown up Christian. My wife is Catholic. I'm still on a journey there to be more consistent, but it's in process.
Well, they say it is definitely about the journey and not the destination. I think it's especially when it comes to the spiritual stuff. I think that if we're doing the work, we're all going to evolve.
Right.
You know, we're all going to evolve, which kind of leads me to this idea that the evolution and the destination, and then you move on to the next realm. What do you imagine that your legacy is going to be? What would you like your legacy to be?
I've never said this publicly, and
you heard it here first.
I want to preface this with, this is not meant to be arrogant. It's not meant to be really about me. I do believe that God has put some gifts within me to connect with other human beings, to take somebody who has always scoffed at work around diversity, equity, and inclusion, and to engage them in a way with respect of the individual, to meet them where they are, and for them to say, wow, nobody ever had that conversation with me like that.
Right.
I think that what I want to leave is the same kind of legacy that Dr. King has left, the same kind of legacy that Gandhi has left, the same kind of legacy that Mother Teresa has left. People who are healers of other people, people who identify love and positivity in each one of us as human beings, but are given a gift to help us to find that love in each other.
Right.
That's what I want my legacy to be. And I feel like every single one of these opportunities I'm blessed to have, including sitting on this stage and being with you, brother, and being with all of you in this audience, is a part of that journey. Now, how that's going to scale and hopefully have that kind of impact in the future, I don't know. But in the deepest part of my heart, I see people who hurt, and that hurts me. And I want to advocate, and I want to love and help all of us to love each other more, not just underrepresented minorities, also people in the majority who are humans as well.
Sure.
That is what I want my legacy to be, inside of corporations, outside of corporations, for my daughter, whose name is Love, and just across this world, if I'm being honest.
So we have one more question before we open it up to questions from you guys. When we were prepping earlier, we talked about this idea of being an entrepreneur and versus being an entrepreneur, and knowing that so many of you are entrepreneurs and founders of companies, we kind of wanted to get into, you know, a conversation about that. So you've been, you know, at all these great companies, but you've also at one point started your own company. So here's how the question is read. On your LinkedIn, it shows that you were a founder and managing partner of Candidate Advisors from 2011 to 2015. And so tell us about your time as a founder. What inspired you to start your own business? And how has being a founder shifted the way you work in other companies and the work you do now?
Thank you. I'll be really quick on this one so that we can get to your questions. And I really hope you all do have like honest questions. Would love to hear from you. Candidate Advisors, I graduated from Harvard Business School in 2009. I turned down this offer to go back to Wall Street to stay and join the admissions board to try to help to get more folks who look like us and from other communities into Harvard Business School. And you know, I did that for 2 years. I interviewed people, et cetera. And so then after 2 years, I went back to Wall Street and was working, and I had all this expertise. And people were like, yo, you need to do something with this. Right. And so I ended up helping people to craft their stories, helping people to look a little bit deeper into themselves and not just describe themselves as the jobs and titles that they had, but also the journeys that they were bringing into an MBA application. And I did that for a few years. I loved it. I was super disorganized. It was a hustle on the side. But when I would have wins along with folks whose lives would be changed because they got into the B school of their dreams, that was what was most fulfilling for me. I think what it's taught me in the corporate space, because then I went to go work for Uber, right, when Uber was only 5 years old and was their first global head of DEI and built that from scratch. What it taught me is things don't always have to be perfect. What it taught me is 75% in a startup as a founder is sometimes good enough. Get it out there because that in and of itself is a test.
Right.
Right? It also just taught me the importance of hiring other people who complement your gaps. Between ADHD and then me just being Damien, I gotta have somebody in there on my team who is structured, who coordinates, who helps to take the vision and the work that I'm doing and make sure that we are meeting the deadlines and the deliverables. And that takes humility. It also takes self-awareness, and then it takes vulnerability to admit it. Yeah. And then it takes action to go out and get it. So yeah. That's what I would say.
That, I mean, that's hopefully you took a nugget out of that, right? Okay. Well, this is our time for Q&A. We have 8 minutes before they wrap. And I see this is the mic over here.
We
so
shared
why don't
the
you
elevator,
line up
didn't
over
we?
Here?
Hey,
and we sure did.
What's up?
Okay. So tell us your name, where you're from, and pose your question. Well, project until they turn it on.
Thank you. Oof. Yeah.
Whatever. But my actual question is around identifying when to innovate within a company or when to lead and innovate from the outside.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The question was kind of when to innovate inside of a company or when it's time to potentially innovate on your own and leave the company, particularly when you're one of the only, right?
Exactly.
And Sharon?
Shara.
Thank you for the question. It's very personal. You might have people relying on you, and you might have hit a plateau inside of that company where you want to leave, where it's dreadful, but where in the hell are you going to get income? Especially if you quit. When you quit, they don't give you severance, right? So where are you gonna get income? So you're not never gonna hear from me as a realist up on stage, oh, well, just take the leap and go. One, your faith's gotta be strong wherever you derive your faith from. Two, I'm not advocating quiet quitting. What I am saying is when you know that it's dead inside, when you're getting up and having more days going into a company where you dread going into that place than you do when you're excited, it's probably a signal. And so what you should be doing is hustling and figuring out what's next. Take every single call that comes your way. Network with every single person who you can network with because you're just setting up for the next move. It's kind of like them relationships that are dead and you know they're dead, right? You just kind of biding that time. That's all it is, right? And so you know it's time to bounce. I would say some of the most successful folks I've seen who leave to innovate, they're playing with that idea already. On the side, right? And I know as an entrepreneur, people say, go all in. You gotta have that right structure around you to be able to go all in, or at least be willing to eat ramen noodles and whatever it is every single night and sleep on somebody's couch until your thing pops, right? So I think it's personal, and I think you've got to already be working on the thing before you bounce.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you, Shara. Hello, what's your name? Where are you from? And what's your question?
So my name is Courtney Tucker, born and raised Cincinnati.
All right.
So my question is, how do you foster innovation within your company? And what methods do you use to kind of encourage creativity within them?
The answer is the same to okay. both of those. Listen. The biggest problem with people who are 44 plus and have salt and pepper beards is we think we know every damn thing.
How about that?
Right? And the reality is, yeah, we know a lot, but what we know from back then might not be relevant today. When you're inside of a company, especially if you're in a role of influence, you already got the mic. By your title, you got the mic. You don't need to be waving the mic around to show that you know everything. In fact, the best leaders listen. And so innovation comes when you tell people you want to hear from them, and then you actually follow through on listening. In my team, I oftentimes have an answer, and I'm like, yeah, I think my answer is about 98% right. And I catch myself sometimes saying, okay, so here's what, and then I say, you know what, hold on. What do y'all think we should do? And a lot of times, I'm gonna get something new out of that, and I'm like, damn, I didn't even think about that. I didn't even know we could do that on TikTok, and then put it into our presentation. And then other times, it gives me an opportunity to hear how they're thinking and to maybe guide and coach there. So listening is the way to do it. That's how you innovate, it's by listening. And then the other thing is the way that you, that's also how you get buy-in. Because imagine you've listened to people, they've given you their input, now you take all the best of what you've heard, that's the thesis for diversity, equity, and inclusion, and then your outcome reflects those people. They're immediate champions of that innovation, right? Okay?
Cool.
All right.
Thank you.
You're
Thank
welcome.
You. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
My name's Ashley, also from Cincinnati, Ohio.
Hey, Ashley.
Went to UC. Any Bearcats?
No. Hey.
My question is, what biases, if any, did you personally have to overcome yourself? And how has that helped you when teaching and bringing more awareness within the companies that you've worked for?
Yeah, that no one's ever asked me that question. So thank you very much. I had to overcome biases towards majority groups. I said to my, so we've moved back to Connecticut, and any questions I can't answer here, if they give us like five more minutes, we can, but if I can't, we'll get to them afterwards. We lived in Cali for a while, moved back to Connecticut, because my mother and grandmother are there. We might be one of like three black families in our very country, very nice and quiet Connecticut town. And I found myself going out now with my daughter, so like I'm extra protective. I'm learning to be a parent. And a father of a daughter at that. And like I would see people who don't look like us, and I'd immediately assume they were looking at me a certain way. And I said to my wife one night, I said, I wonder how many great opportunities to just engage with other human beings I miss out on because I have biases that they have biases against me. Mm-hmm. And half the time I'm probably right. The other half, they're probably looking like, I'd love to just go and say hello, but he probably doesn't want to hear from insert community that's not black. And so I would actually say to you that it is a constant, right? Unconscious bias and going through those things, that just makes you aware of it. It's a muscle you have to build on a regular basis to stay aware of it inside of spaces, especially in corporate spaces. Right? And so I don't know that there's a bias that I've necessarily overcome. There are biases that live with me and have been instilled since I was a kid that I'm working on a regular basis to check myself on, right? And I would say that's one of the biggest ones is projecting out things that are half the time true and half the time's not.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. So how are okay. we on time?
I got a thumbs up.
You got thumbs? Okay, cool. Let's go. Hello.
Hi. I'm Meredith Whitehead. I live in Cincinnati, but I'm from Akron, Ohio. And so, okay, this is probably a loaded question, so bear with me.
Okay.
So you talked a lot about your position and things that you do inside your, like, you know, you're talking about politics and all of these different things. your title is Chief Impact
Officer. Yes.
Right. Okay. So with that, and you know, when we're talking about politics in a world where we've got critical race theory, you see a lot of affirmative action is disappearing, all these major Supreme Court decisions. You also see titles such as yours mm-hmm. that used to be diversity, equity, and inclusion officer roles. Mm-hmm. They're changing to social impact mm-hmm. or, I don't know, innovation, mm-hmm. human resources is changing to people and culture.
Yep.
So my question is, in a world that is becoming, and just to be blunt, kind of whitewashed, mm. right, and trying to erase a large history and existence of us, the culture, right? How do you keep that relevant, especially when diversity, equity, and inclusion are a small piece of what we need to sustain and thrive as a people? So I see racial equity as that, and I see diversity, equity, and inclusion as tools to drive racial equity, but no one talks about racial equity so much in these conversations. So how do you keep diversity, equity, and inclusion when you're a social impact person, when there's still these systemic and institutionalized disparities that exist?
Yeah, thank you for the question. So they're not mutually exclusive, right? And maybe I'll tell you a little bit about why Chief Impact Officer, and that will answer a bit of your question. I chose that title. I wrote my job description. And when I left Zoom, I was done. I was done with being a chief diversity officer, because I don't go into these companies just for equity or for notoriety. That's like the last thing I care about. I go to impact. And I was at a place where I was tired of being told that by a number of companies, and tired of hearing my peers say the same story. We were told in the interview process, people are ready for this. And then you get in, it's good at first, and then 6 months in, it's like, oh wow, your vision for what good is very different from my vision. And so I was done. I was gonna take off 6 months and just go spend time with my daughter. And this opportunity came. And I said, well, the only way that I can do this, and by the way, I've worked with the current CEO, Scott Cutler. He was CEO of StubHub when I was eBay's first chief diversity officer. So I helped him build his strategy and watched him actually follow through with money and with time. And that was focused on diversity, equity, and inclusion. And so I said, okay, there's some precedent. I know this person. But I said, one, I can't report into HR. I have to report directly to you. Two, I need a team. Three, I need a budget. And four, because quite honestly, I'm getting tired of just doing DEI only, which tends to be very internally focused. I also need to own external community engagement, so how we show up from a philanthropic standpoint, but also how we support Black-owned businesses, minority-owned businesses, especially in Detroit, right? And I need to play a major role in sustainability. Now, that last part is important. I sit on the board of a company called Harry's. If you know, shave, regardless of your gender identity, we own a company called Lumi, another company, you know, Harry's Flamingo. And I sit on that board and we talk about ESG. If anybody doesn't know what ESG stands for, it's an acronym that stands for environmental, social impact, and governance. Investors are talking about ESG. Investors talk about it, which means the board of directors talks about it. And so for me, becoming a chief impact officer, changing my reporting structure, but also opening up the things that my team owns to not just be DEI, but to also be things around the environment and philanthropic, was not only self-serving for me to continue to grow as a leader, but it was also strategic, because you know what happens and what will continue to happen? People are gonna continue to talk about the environment. They might try not to talk about racial justice, racial equity, and DEI. But if you're being asked to go and talk to the board about the environment and about ESG because your team owns it, you can never expect that I'm going to get there and not talk about racial equity, racial justice, and DEI. And so in many ways, it's an acknowledgement of the world. I won't use the term you use because I'm on camera, but it's an acknowledgement of the world broadening and diluting this conversation and me saying, ah, I'm hip, I see you. We're not going to stop talking about DEI, but if you want to change that little umbrella of it, that's cool, but I own that umbrella. See what I'm saying? And so the legislation that's out there, the organization, some companies are real about it and some are not. And some companies think they're real and then they realize what it takes and they're not. I can't speak for all those companies. I can speak for me and to simply say, it's exactly what you've articulated, this attack on it, for why I pivoted. But I still have it, and it still is a core part of every decision that is gonna be made. The last thing I'll say is, we also have to be real about, think about it like marketing. When people hear the word diversity, because a lot of diversity, equity, and inclusion has been done really wrong.
Facts.
When they hear that word, they run. I don't want you to run. I'm trying to be Gandhi. I'm trying to be Dr. King. I want you to come in. I don't want to call you out. I want to call you in. And so if I know that the nomenclature that has been used historically already makes people run before I ever even come in the door, I don't have to change the core of the work. But I can be hip and understand that the branding of it might need to be different in order for the work to actually survive. Does that make sense? Okay.
Thank you.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I guess it's the end of our time. Let's get a round of applause for Damian Hooper-Campbell.
That was Damian Hooper-Campbell in a conversation with Thornell Jones, reminding us that leadership without empathy is incomplete, and that innovation starts with how we show up for ourselves and for others. If this episode moved you, be sure to subscribe to Road to Black Tech Week, leave a review, and share it with a colleague or friend. And join us live at Black Tech Week 2025, July 14th through the 16th in Cincinnati, Ohio. You'll find the full schedule and registration at blacktechweek.com. Until next time, build bravely, lead consciously, and stay connected.